Merry Christmas, Nightcasters. We hope you're having a wonderful holiday season, and we thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen to this Yuletide episode of our Batman podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
We've got a silent, dark night tale to discuss while you sip your eggnog and organize your presents in piles of return and keep. But it's not just Ryan and I this time. No, we're joined by one of our own personal secret Santas and one of the Fire and Water Network's favorite guests. Please welcome to the Batcave, Captain Entropy. Hey, Captain.
Hello, citizens. Happy to be here.
Nice. Well, we're glad to have you here. The secret questions are the new thing on the Fire and Water Podcast Network, and we all just love Sean bringing him over here. Yeah, but no, seriously.
You're right. It's Sean's fault.
Yeah. We're wondering, do you have a particular holiday tradition when it comes to comics? Are there any issues or stories or collections you have to read every December by your tree?
There are not. There are some that come up in my mind every year, though. I remember Superboy and the Legion in the old holiday special, going in search of the Christmas star. There are other stories like the Marvel Christmas Tales that I really didn't even know about until Rob Kelly's Treasury cast. I have several treasuries, but I didn't get any of the Christmas ones. And there's a favorite Hanukkah tale. All the Jewish superheroes of the Marvel universe have Chinese food together. So I don't read them every year, but maybe that's a tradition I should start.
Gotcha. What about you, Ryan?
Yeah, I think I've actually podcasted about most of my favorite Christmas comics. I did the Justice League story that was done on a different show on this network just very recently. I've podcasted about a Nick Fury Christmas story. Of course, Ant-Man's Big Christmas was a favorite of mine. There's one that I haven't really talked about. I talked about it with Shag on the last holiday special for Justice Society Presents. It was an issue of Generation X, one of the X-Men books from the 90s. Issue 4, it was a story called Between the Cracks, ostensibly a Christmas story, but it also dealt with a student being bullied because of his physical deformities, ends up taking his whole classroom hostage and has very kind of tragic outcomes. And the whole thing is that the sort of ironic and tragic twist was that he wasn't even a mutant. He just looked different. Yeah, other than that, I mean, in preparation for this one, I read a handful of Batman Christmas comics. Listeners, I'll let you know, we almost picked a Christmas comic with Dr. Zinzin, but I thought that was just too much for one calendar year to cover him, to cover him that much. So,
has Dr. Ange really been that good this year?
good question. Yeah, that one is nuts. I actually wrote an article for Back Issue about Bronze Age Batman Christmas stories, so I kind of know all of them. So years ago, but there's collections I get out like every year. Like I get the DC Digest, the Best of DC Digest, the Christmas with the Superheroes issue. I get out the two Christmas with the Superheroes from the 80s. The first one was a reprint. The second one was new stories. And you know, I think I'm like with you, Ryan. I think I've covered about almost all my favorite Christmas comics at one point or another across multitude of shows. I dig those out. I dig the treasuries out. And in fact, one of the treasuries, the second of the DC Christmas treasuries, just as we record this, the facsimile just came out this week. So if you need a good Christmas collection of DC stories, well, there's one on the shelf right now. I just think it's fun to get them out and reread them every year. It's kind of a tradition. I don't do it every year, but I try to. So I'm hoping to sneak all that in again this year.
Chris, you just added something to my Christmas list. You mentioned the Batman episodes. The Batman issues. I'm not trying to make this longer, but I immediately thinking about Batman singing Christmas carols in the precinct house. So.
Yeah, the silent night of the Batman. Yeah.
And the first Miller story, Frank Miller Batman story, rather, was a Christmas story. So.
Yeah.
A high school girlfriend got me the Frank Miller Batman hardcover for Christmas. And that story is the first story in there. It's a pretty cool gift, but yeah. I mean, she wasn't the one, but I still remember.
She'll always have a place in your heart because she got you the Frank Miller Batman.
Exactly.
You know, it turns out Frank Miller wasn't the one either, but you know, it was good times back then. It was good times when we were younger.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about a specific Christmas comic. That would be Batman Legends of the Dark Knight number 79, which has a January 1996 cover date, but should have hit the streets on December 7th, 1995, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. The cover is by Steve, do we say Yowl, or how do we say his name?
I think Yowl or something like that. Like, I don't know, but put some Kentucky into it. Yowl or something.
This cover's by Steve Yowl. Steve Yowl.
There you go. So that's the first three letters are the first letters of Yeoman, like Yeoman Rand from Star Trek.
Right.
Yowl.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Yeah, let's go with that. Yeah. The cover is by Steve Yowl and Dick Giordano. It shows the titular Dark Knight framed by a festive holiday wreath. Very festive, except for that Batman is in agony because he's on fire. So what do you think of this cover, Captain?
I think it's a terrific public service announcement for safety for at Christmas time with the wreaths, like the ones here that Batman is actually inside of a giant wreath, or your Christmas trees, especially the live Christmas trees that get dried out and, you know, you got to shorten the lights. It's dangerous. Now, this cover is really eye-catching, and, you know, it does the job of making me want to find out what's going on inside. What's interesting is that what's going on in not at all this, although it is a Batman Christmas story, I don't remember a point where he was on fire. I don't remember a wreath, but, you know, it gets my attention. And it's got favorite things at the bottom, which makes me think of the, you know, the song lyric. Mm-hmm. And it is a very appropriate title for what the story is about.
Ryan, what do you think?
I hate it. No, I'm joking. I don't know why this just came to me, but the circular frame of the wreath and the snow falling over it makes me think of a snow globe, which this is very much not a snow globe image, but for some reason that's kind of where my mind went to. But yeah, I like the contrast of the fire and the snow or ice. The look of Batman is very dramatic, and yeah, it's a pretty image with a disturbing twist thrown into it, which is appropriate for this type of thing.
Yeah, it's a strong cover. I mean, I remember when it came out, I'm like, oh, you know, one, it's a Batman Christmas story, so I'm like, ooh, you know, that I always like a good Batman Christmas story, and I was buying every issue of Legends of the Dark Knight anyway, but if I hadn't been, I probably would have bought this just from the cover.
One minor thing that I like now that we're looking at it so closely is the Gothic font that makes it very different from, you know, there's plenty of comic book covers have text on them, but usually so traditional.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They tend to break this type of font out for Christmas comics, you know, like Christmas with the superheroes is often in this type of font. So yeah, this Gothic old English type Gothic font. Yeah, I love it.
Yep.
So Favorite Thing was written by Mark Millar with art by Steve Yowl and Dick Giordano. Batman prowls the streets of Gotham more frantically than usual because, as ludicrous as it sounds, Wayne Manor was burglared and the thieves took something of immense value to the Bat. A blind woman named Tabitha, who has an auditory talent for hearing criminal scuttlebutt, gets attacked by a gang of Joker devotees called Joy Boys. Batman has no trouble saving her and asks what she knows about a gang of burglars who target rich houses. Tabitha tells him the gang is called the Chessmen, their leader called the King. Commissioner Gordon tells Batman the cops have the Chessmen's hideout surrounded, but the criminals murdered one officer and have taken another hostage. Batman does his thing, takes out the Chessmen, saves the hostage, and learns where the gang stashed their loot. When Batman arrives at the stash house, however, he finds a desperate father and his hungry kids. He agreed to hold the goods because his family needed the money, but his conscience got the better of him, so he tipped off the cops to the Chessmen's location. Batman takes pity on the man and leaves him a wad of cash instead of bat cuffs. Back at Wayne Manor, Alfred finds Bruce Wayne in his old bedroom playing with what he recovered from the stolen loot, a toy train, the last Christmas present Bruce's parents gave him before they died. So, Captain, what do we think of the story?
I think it's a good Christmas story and a good Batman story. It's a very straightforward Batman story. This is pretty much what you expect to get from Batman in the mid-90s. And I don't think it's the best Batman story. I think some of the 70s ones that you've written about are probably a little better. I would have liked to have seen a little more Bruce Wayne, but I still really enjoyed it.
I like this one a lot, and I actually didn't read this at the time. I think I had kind of like dipped out of the ancillary Bat titles right after kind of Nightfall and Nightquest during that era. So I missed this one the first time it came around. But when I was hunting for a Christmas book for this month, I saw this one just kind of in the listing. I was like, really? A Christmas Batman story by Mark Miller, of all people? I was like, I don't know if we're ever going to get another chance to talk about Mark Miller on one of our podcasts. But I certainly had thoughts about him, and I'll come back to those a little bit later. But I did read this one, and I got a kick out of it. First, it's a nice little one-off. It feels very old-fashioned in a way. This, and well, part of this goes to my thoughts on Mark Miller and how he writes so much, sometimes intentionally, for other media projects, and how he kind of like writes his comics to be adapted into film or television or something. Like this one, I was like, how has this not been adapted into a Batman cartoon? Why was this not part of the animated series or one of the other cartoons, like the Batman? Like, this seems like a great little one-off holiday special that with very little modifications they could have done as a cartoon episode. And I think it would have been really successful.
He also did the comic that was based on Batman, the animated series, for a while, right?
He did Superman.
Oh, you're right. He was.
I don't know if he did
he was doing Superman.
Yeah, he may have done Batman too, but he did Superman for sure.
You could have done this in the, you know, Paul Dini, Bruce Timm, Timverse, and it would totally have worked. And that's as a story for that too.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I was kind of thinking that too. This feels like they probably would have to have Tabitha have a different occupation than exotic dancer, but
what's more wholesome than an aging blind exotic? Come on.
Chris, you know what Bruce Timm's preferences would have been. If he could have gotten around the network censors, he definitely would have had that.
He just wouldn't have made it so obvious.
Like that scene where Batgirl like stops and talks to some ladies of the night, and one looks like Black Canary, and is that in Return of the Joker, I think? Batman Beyond Return of the Joker? Yeah, something like that, yeah. But yeah, I agree, I'll be honest, I couldn't remember what the story was. I remember, you know, when Ryan's like, I was thinking about doing this, and I'm like, oh, is that the one where he's in the... I remembered the cover, but I didn't remember the story, which as soon as I got in started reading it, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's this one. I remember there was, in the back of my brain, there was a, you know, Batman story where he's searching for a toy that his parents gave him, but I hadn't thought of this one in a long time, and it is a good one. It is very kind of by the numbers Batman. It's almost like, I said Millar, but you're probably right, it's Miller. I don't even know if we pronounce Steve Yeol's name correctly, so I might be murdering every person on this creative team, their names. I don't know how much if he wrote Batman any before this, or, you know, I think this is probably fairly early in his career, I would think, at least in American comics. And I didn't look that up, should have, didn't, but it's
I'll work
like
on that while you're talking.
You can Google while I'm talking, but I feel like he's kind of like, if this is my one Batman story, I'm going to work in all the cool Batman tropes, you know, which is fine. I mean, he does a good job with it, so it's entertaining, but it's... But the little emotional hook, of course, at the end is a nice, nice sentimental little bit there, especially from somebody that writes comics that often aren't very sentimental. So,
yeah, and it is the end that makes it, and I'm sure we'll get to that. And by the way, so I did Google earlier because I wanted to make sure I was right that the pronunciation, it is Miller as though his name were spelled M-I-L-L-E-R.
Okay.
And as a handy pronunciation guide, they misspelled his name on the front page.
Well, there you go. They wanted to say that was a Batman story by Miller. That's what they wanted to, you know. Oh, it's by
Miller. Yeah, it was deliberate.
So I apologize for saying Miller.
Hey, you're right, by the way. It is he did do Adventures of Superman, but he didn't do the Batman comic.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Before this one, he had been working on Swamp Thing for about 2 years. This was the only other thing at DC that he had done up to this point. He had done some UK stuff, like late 80s, early 90s. But then his kind of like mainstream DC stuff really just started in early 94. About 2 years before this, he was doing Swamp Thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and he's Scottish, so he probably knows Martin and Matt and Doug Adamson.
They all live on the same block, I think. That's what I get, you know.
There can't be that many of them, you know. Like, if you ask Paul Hicks about an Australian, it's like, well, I actually know him, but, you know, I have a friend who's related to him. Like, there's a 50-50 chance.
All right. So I like that we get the 1950 Dick Sprang Batmobile, at least in the splash, but then later I feel like the Batmobile shape and model completely changes in the story, like with almost every panel it's in. But
it's a Transformers crossover.
There you go. Steve Yoel, I know from, Steve, how did we say we're going to pronounce it? Yeoman. Steve Yoel, not Yule, like, as in Christmas.
It rhymes with Noel or something.
Noel, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Yoel.
Steve Yoel I remember him from Starman. He did some fill-ins on Starman when Tony Harris was still the main penciler and before Peter Snaber joined the title. In fact, he did one of the Christmas, the Christmas issue of Starman that we covered many moons ago on Supermate. So this is his first superhero Christmas story, perhaps, but he at least does one more. So,
well, neat. Mm-hmm. His style looks like it would not be a jarring transition from Harris to him.
No, it was pretty, he fit, you know, he definitely fit that title pretty well. I feel like Dick Giordano is, especially with Batman, he's kind of changing Batman into his Batman, but it's Dick Giordano. He's been drawing or inking Batman for 30 years at this point, right? So, almost 30 years. So, he's kind of got his own take on Batman, which I'm not complaining about, so... We do get the yellow oval, though, Ryan, which is unusual in Legend of the Dark Knight, especially the story set in the past. So I don't know if that was just the thing that Yoel decided to do and nobody went back and changed it, or maybe Dick Giordano decided he wanted to draw the oval and changed it. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't remember how long they kept that up, that idea that these were like stories from Batman's past and Legends of the Dark Knight, because I figured by the time they got to the company crossovers and everything at that point, they were sort of contemporary. So I didn't even automatically think of this as like a story from like Batman's like year one or year two era. I thought it was just more of a contemporary story, but could have been. I don't know.
There's nothing about this story that makes it specific to a particular time in Batman's career. So you could do yellow oval or no yellow oval. You know, that doesn't matter.
Yeah. The only thing is Gordon is Captain Gordon, but he's promoted, demoted times. It doesn't really matter, I guess. So right now he's a beat cop in the current Batman comic. Yeah. Right. So,
right.
So Wayne Manor is burgled in the middle of a party. Isn't that in The Dark Knight Rises? Maybe Christopher Nolan read this comic, because he read the last comic we covered with Clayface, because The Narrows is mentioned. So
I don't know. Oh, you know what I think it is?
What?
Christopher Nolan used some Inception to plant the ideas for these comics in my mind. And that's why, like, he's, you know, I'm sort of subconsciously going after his catalog of all of the things that he did his movies on with my Batman reading.
Oh, there you go. Wow. That top's still spinning, huh? Crazy. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. I do think there's, I don't know if this is Miller being cheeky, but when Alfred says, perhaps we should invest in a large dog with a taste for for the criminal classes. It makes me think: Is he referencing Ace the Bat Hound here? You know,
that's what I thought. Yeah,
maybe he's like. I mean, I know he's the father figure, but maybe he's like the kid that's trying to soften you up to the idea of bringing.
In a more recent Batman comic, Alfred was instrumental in introducing Batman and Ace the Bat Hound, and that was a great story written by our favorite writer, Tom King.
Yes. I read that one. Oh, that is a good one.
Yeah. Actually, so other than killing Alfred, which is a terrible move, I agree with y'all, although, like you said, some good stories came out of it, but Batman is supposed to be tortured, right? At least to some degree. So I think he's less damaging to Batman than he is to other brighter characters.
I could be. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. He didn't have Batman like accidentally kill like a whole group of superheroes and then be messed up about it, like Wally West or whatever, right? Or so.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tom King. It seems to me, and I've seen the guy at conventions, but I've not spoken with him. It seems to me like he's working out his trauma, or he has something to say about trauma and suffering, and he's doing that through these characters. And for a lot of these characters, that's just not a natural fit. But for Batman, it totally is. So he doesn't really change anything.
Yeah, and I think that's probably why he was on Batman for, it was like 4 or 5 years at least.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if he ever set him on fire like the cover, but he may have. But we do get a pretty loose connection to the cover because the Joy Boys have burned an effigy of Batman at a front of a museum that they firebombed. That's where the cover comes in, which is very loose.
I really appreciate that because, and no offense to Yoel or Yoel, I could not figure out, like, I saw the bat symbol, but I did not see the whole effigy, and I wasn't making the connection. So I appreciate your more learned artistic eye helping me out with that.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, yeah, it is hard to see. I think because in that panel, you see the close-up of the bat symbol with no oval burning, and then that you see the, like, through the legs of the cop, and the effigy's burning, but it's in like a color hold, like it's like the outline of it is kind of red. You can barely see his like cowl right above the flames. It's like, yeah, that wasn't
right. I see it now.
Yeah, it's hard to read.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So, yeah, somebody in either the coloring or the art let the story down there. So, oh well, it happens sometimes.
So the security at Stately Wayne Manor, even Alfred comments on the fact that they have security, but, you know, the gang that we learn as the Chessmen has broken in. Does anybody else think this is a little crazy that no alarm, or maybe alarms did go off, and that's why they were only able to make it with a toy train?
Yeah, that's the part. I mean, they point out how kind of incredible it is that somebody managed to rob Wayne Manor, but it's like they're just still kind of hand waving. How did they rob Wayne Manor? You know, it's like, you know, it's, I mean, he's got to have security just to protect the Batcave, you know, I mean, it, let alone the house, you know. So, how did a couple of, you know, Royal Flesh Gang wannabes like still, you know, break into Wayne Manor? Good point.
My headcanon, well, they shouldn't have gotten onto the grounds without somebody noticing them or some sensor or something. But my headcanon is going to be that, you know, they did a great job getting to the skylight or whatever. But when they finally broke in, alarms went off. And, you know, the only thing they were able to make off with was, you know, the toy train and a couple other things.
I think because there's obviously a party at Wayne Manor because Batman had to, Bruce had to slip away from it. So I think they snuck in as part of the party, maybe as guests or caterers or something like that. I'm sure they were able to sneak in that way. I mean, that's kind of how Selina did it in the aforementioned Dark Knight Rises.
Mm-hmm.
I also think in just, but I, of course there is just like a smashed window too. So it's like, all right, well, did they sneak in like in disguise or was it literally a smash and grab?
Well, but you would lower security, like, you know,
right.
You wouldn't have it, every motion sensor on if you were going to have a bunch of people driving in. So, yeah, that makes total sense.
I also think, I mean, this flies in the face of the idea that Batman is just this super paranoid guy who plans for every contingency. But maybe not if this was really early in his career, as it might have been. But there's kind of just this failure of imagination, maybe. Like, he's so protective of the Batman persona that it never occurs to him to protect Bruce Wayne's actual assets.
Oh, sure.
Until something like this happens. And then he's like, oh, yeah, duh.
Yeah, you're right. The cop who doesn't lock the door of the squad car.
Right, yeah.
The scene where Batman interrogates, you know, the drug dealer Eddie Mulligan, I mean, it seems really harsh, especially since he really doesn't know anything about it. I mean, Batman like shoves this guy's head in the toilet. I mean, I know it's like, you know, it's again typical Batman stuff, but it's like he didn't even get any information. Usually when he does this type of stuff, he gets information out of him, you know. It's not as bad as when he threatened that profile guy in the Bar Davis run. with sending him to prison and the implications therein that he would be very popular there. But still, it's like, I know this guy's probably not a good person, but I still feel like it's Batman seems excessively rough with this guy.
Yeah, but as drug dealers known for selling to criminals go, Eddie seems to be a stand-up guy, because as soon as Batman comes in and says, hey, hand over Eddie Mullivan and save yourself some grief, he sticks his head out and says, hi, Bats, looking for me, big guy? So, he at least doesn't let anybody else have to deal with them. Maybe that's why, he's probably, despite his job, he's a little more likable than the average thug. So we probably feel his swirly a little bit more empathetically.
Yeah, I think that's it. He seems like a polite, criminal, drug peddler. So.
Yeah. And his mother died when he was 4, which we learn in conversation.
Right. So. Yeah. Yeah. That too.
I was just distracted by the fact that this guy's name is Mulligan. I don't mean to profile or anything, but a young black guy wearing a bandana or a do-rag or something. I was like, his name is Mulligan? I was like,
Other people can have Irish names, Ryan Daly.
I'm sure. Yeah, it definitely could be.
Yeah. Well, again, we've got Tabitha, who apparently is, she is a dancer at the I Spy live stage show, adults only. And some of the panels, the way that they color, it looks like she's just, like, the first panel you see her in, like, looks like she's just got a very diaphanous skirt on and nothing else. I know later they show she's got a mini skirt underneath that, but it's like the first panel, I'm like, whoa, what am I looking at here?
Yeah.
But she's, I like the little bit. This reminds me of Len Wein tried to build up the informants Batman had. He had a few that he'd go to. They're in the Legends of the Dark Knight miniseries and Untold Legend of the Batman miniseries and in his run. And it kind of reminded me of that. You get the feeling Batman knows her. So and they've encountered each other before. He's very friendly to her.
And the way that Yoel draws her, and not anybody else in here, but just her, reminds me a little bit of the old Carmine Infantino Flash, like latter Carmine Infantino. But yeah, she clearly has some sort of information relationship with Batman, and she talks about it to a cab driver, which I would not do. I would not share that I was passing information along to Batman about the criminal element.
No, it's probably not a good idea. Yeah.
Especially because this cab driver, Ernie, doesn't seem like a stand-up guy.
No.
Boys show up, he just turns and runs and leaves the blind woman in the back of his cab.
Yes.
Yeah. He does look like he can follow instructions. So,
right.
They told him to get out of the car, and he got way out of the car.
The Joy Boys remind me of the Jokers with a Z from Batman Beyond. I think this would be this was before that, though. So that's nice. But I like their big Joker J on the back of their jacket, though. That's nice that they've got the proper branding from the Joker logo. That's a nice touch.
I have to respect that. So.
It's pretty brutal. I mean, it's a small panel, but that last panel on that page where they slap her, very hard, backhand her, and then you see through Batman's hands, like his perspective, he's coming down, but it looks like they're literally like kicking her and stomping her, which is pretty rough. It's like, dang, Batman's entrance here is better than the one we get later, I will say that, but I will say, though, too, he commands the Batmobile to run this Joy Boy over. So was Zack Snyder reading this comic book?
Yeah, really. But it was just a glancing angle. So the Joy Boy is fine. The Batmobile is very strained in its use of violence.
Right. Yes.
I like Batman's line where the Joy Boy says there are some things in life it's best not to see. And Batman just follows up on it as he's like landing on top of the guy, and one has just dropped in on him.
Yeah.
I thought that was a pretty good one-liner.
Yeah, that's Batman's action one-liner right there. It's good, yeah. And I like his, "Joy Boys, your choice of role model stinks." You know, I like that too, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, notice I don't try to do the voice. I might try to do the voice on their podcast, but not with you.
I have to, or Siskoid will fire me. So I've got to keep, I got to keep all of them going, you know, but I wonder with Tabitha here, the way Yoel draws her eyes, it looks like she's scarred around her eyes. So it almost makes me look like she's not like natural, like something, some kind of accident, or there was something inflicted on her that blinded her almost. It makes me
radioactive isotope.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
I just thought they were maybe not very well drawn, like age wrinkles. Like I got the feeling I kind of got the impression that like this for an exotic dancer, she's a little bit long in the tooth. Doesn't have like a 90s Image Comics female figure.
No.
I just kind of thought that maybe like, yeah, she's a little bit older. Maybe the eye spy isn't the, you know, hottest spot for young men looking for a glimpse of the girls. But
yeah, that was my first two. But I mean, but it honestly, the intent could go either way.
We'll probably never know. I don't think Tabitha ever appears again. Well, I have to check the Mike's Amazing World and see if he's listed a character list of appearances for her. But I don't think so. So
yeah.
But yeah, the Batmobile here now looks like the one that Paul Galassi designed for the Prey storyline in Legends of the Dark Knight, because it does not have the bat head on the front as it's going down the road. Doesn't have the big fin. It's he literally maybe just switched Batmobiles. You know. Speaking of which, while we'll have another question, secret question here, and you listeners can let us know. What's your favorite Batmobile, Captain?
Oh, my gosh. You probably know the name. I've been asked this before, but it was the 70s one that looked like a muscle car, that looked like it was somewhere between a Corvette and a Ferrari.
Yeah.
And it's probably the least practical because there's no room in there for everything, but it just looked the coolest.
Yeah, the Neil Adams, one, yeah.
That's it, yeah.
That's nice, yeah. I think that inspired the Batman muscle car, Batmobile, definitely, yeah. Yeah, that's
good. Yeah.
What about you, Ryan? I don't know if we've ever discussed this before. We may have, but
I wouldn't have said this a couple of years ago, but it has grown on me so much. It might be the 1966 TV show Batmobile. I always have a soft spot for the 1989 movie version. From the comics, I do like the one that that Captain mentioned, the Neil Adams like muscle car one, but I also like the one, Chris, that it looks like at the beginning of this one. Like I like a Batmobile with that has a face on the front of it. There's just something so weird about it, but I dig that too.
Yeah, that my favorites are again like Ryan said, media. It's the 66. That's my favorite period. I mean, to me, that's just the Batmobile. I love the 89. I also like the Batman, but if I was going to pick two, those two, and then from the comics, it's the 50 Dick Sprang bubble dome bat head big fin Batmobile at the beginning of this, and then the late 70s 80s slash superpowers Batmobile that I think Dick Giordano
designed,
the buggy kind of looking one that's a little bit like that muscle car, but it puts the fins back on it, and I really love that one. So those are my favorites.
Cool.
Yeah. So, you listeners, let us know what your favorite Batmobiles are. That's your homework for this episode.
Bonus points for the one in Absolute Batman, the new comic, because the Batmobile is like one of those like ginormous construction vehicles that's like this. It looks like it's the size of like a Walgreens or something like that he's driving around in. It's amazing.
It would have to be for him to fit in it. You know, I mean, you know.
No, yeah. No, but like, seriously, like the Batmobile from his tank from The Dark Knight Returns, the Miller one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like he looked at the Absolute Batman one. It's like, that's a little ostentatious, honestly.
Absolute Batman said, hold my beer. Yeah. OK, Okay, so then we find out that the chessmen are the guys who've been robbing the mansions in Gotham, and as soon as Batman finds that out, Gordon signals him and tells him that, yes, they were tipped off about that too, and now the police chief sniffs headlines, and he rushed the place, and now he's got two cops hostage, and of course, then Batman takes off. And so the chessmen, I know, yeah, chess and playing cards, not the same, but it's the guy's name, the leader's name's King, and I'm thinking, like, yeah, like I said before, is this like a wannabe knockoff Royal Flush Gang with bad hair? I mean, I don't know, you know?
Yeah, they have some really bad hair. I mean, these guys are in the mid-90s. They are a dated stereotype of the gang thug, because it's like, no, these guys are 80s punk, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The one guy looks like the Slim Jim guy that was from the 90s in the commercial.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe it was early 2000s. I don't know, but you know what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Batman's investigation turns out completely unnecessary because the police get this anonymous tip.
Yes, and apparently they're at some kind of, looks like a, like again, a chemical factory that, you know, because there's smoke, there's some kind of industrial factory, you know, it looks like Axis Chemicals from the outside, you know. And there's nothing that, the art in here is fine, but I will say the panel where Batman's jumping down on him going, "You're mine," I mean, that one, I don't know. That's just kind of weak for a big Batman entrance. The way he's holding his cape, and he's got his arms down at his side. I know he's like basically like making his cape into a parachute type thing, but it's like, I don't know. It doesn't strike fear into or awe into me. I'm not trying to be overly critical, but
well, he's not to land on you. But yeah.
As a gang, I do think the chessmen here are kind of weak sauce. I mean, yeah, a Royal Flush Gang appearance would have been a little bit more significant. But I also think for this story, it is so grounded and it's so personal and comparatively small for Batman, but huge for Bruce. This didn't have to be a gang with like a gimmick. This could have just been like the Mulligan Gang. I need to use that same character, his name again, or something like that. But like, you know, they didn't have to have weird haircuts and playing card tattoos on their foreheads. It could have just been this gang that hits big houses or something like that. It could have been like Robert De Niro's crew from Heat or something like that. Just draw them as regular guys and he takes them down, because that's, they don't need identities for this story, for their part in it.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that the artist or maybe the writer prescribed this, but I think he's trying to add some visual interest. But I think I probably would have had more respect for these guys if they'd looked like, you know, the crew from Heat.
Yeah.
Batman was limited on how openly he could investigate this. I get the impression that people robbing mansions weren't a priority for him until he stole his toy train. And he goes around like, yeah, you know, and I get it, you know, like, okay, I can help the underprivileged, or I can help the overprivileged, and everybody's a victim of crime. And then he has to go around and say, "I'm after a gang who specializes in robbing big houses." Can't say, I need to find the guys who robbed Wayne Manor on Tuesday night, you know, because probably wasn't Tuesday night. It was probably a weekend. But, you know, that would be a little too obvious. It's a good thing that Wayne Manor wasn't the first house that they hit.
Yeah, good point. And like we said, how did these guys, like if they, apparently they did just break in because the window, because I can't see these guys like hiding their hair.
Oh yeah.
It's gonna stick out. Yeah.
Yeah, you know what, maybe they had caps on as like catering.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go. Chef's big hats, chef hats. Yeah, there you go. That's it.
Actually, I just thought I had this scene because like flashing back to when he's holding Mulligan's head over the toilet and everything, and Mulligan's sort of, "I don't know anything about these guys who rob houses. Like, I can tell you what the Scarecrow is doing this week. I can tell you who the Penguin is robbing." And Batman's like, "I don't care about those guys. I want this gang that's robbed Wayne Manor."
"Where's your train? I want the train."
Yeah, yeah, whatever. Laughing fish, don't care.
Yeah. Of course, you know, Miller, this might be the first time that somebody else ever reused the bat call from Batman Year One. I don't remember it being overly utilized in the comics. You know, I mean, it obviously got used in Batman Begins. It's not in his boot, but he's got it out in his utility belt, and he calls in the bats, and they attack the king, and then, you know, Batman makes short work of him.
We actually see the open pouch that he got the thing out of, and I don't think I can specifically remember a time when I saw that, and I think that's pretty cool, because it's a cinema verite in there. And then when he presses the button, the bats are there instantly. So did he pre-position the bats? Like, you know, did he have them come with him? Or does he happen to know that there's a cave right near the industrial site? They're pretty close.
Maybe he keeps them packed in the Batmobile, like in the Bat Ski Boat in Batman Returns when they come out.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Oh, one more thing I thought of. So I have to bring up something military so I can stay on brand. But the survival vest that military pilots wear, everything in the pockets, and that, you know, there's little pouches on survival vests, they're all tied to the vest. And we call that dummy cording. And I would have everything in that belt dummy corded, because if it were me, the fight would start before I could get the thing back in the pouch, and I'd never see that again. And then you'd have, you know, kids on the street in Gotham calling bats.
Some kid's going to have one hell of a show and tell, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
That's great.
Now you just got me wondering if Batman has to get all of these bats back into his cage in the Batmobile. if he has another call, if he's like throwing orange slices or cherries in there and everything just to bring them back.
Different signal, and then there's bait. I like that. And then he has a fruit fly problem because they come with
that is Alfred's least favorite part of the job, is cleaning out the bat cage.
Alfred's got to store the Whirly Bat in the trunk of the Batmobile, and he forgets that the bats are in there. And he opens the trunk and just...
Oh, God. Full of bat mono.
Those guys must get, like, rabies vaccines more often than dogs do.
Yeah.
Like, it's got to be an annual thing for them. Like, all the robins, all the kids, everybody who was in that cave.
Yes. So at the bottom of the page where the bats attack, the king is like, Chessman, where are you, Chessman? King under attack. And... what I really wanted him to say was, to me, my chessmen.
Oh, that'd been great. So Batman knocks, you know, King around, and then, you know, throws a batarang with a bat rope around him and tells him to talk. And then the police chief comes in, Yeats, who they've made a big deal of as this publicity hound. Batman leaves him a note that tells him, like, you know, act like a police chief, not a publicity hound, Yeats, or I'll have to act. I won't always have more urgent business like tonight. Again, you guys are right. The urgent business is finding a toy train, not stopping the Joker from poisoning the reservoir, not stopping Scarecrow from unleashing fear gas on a stadium or something, you know. So,
I don't know if you would be this wrapped around the axle if they took your favorite blow mold.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, then I'd be doing Christian Bale Batman voice then, you know, that's.
But I have to ask, are they out yet?
Oh, yeah. I put them out I knew the weather was going to be good. So I actually put them out the weekend before Thanksgiving. I've started doing it early. The older I get, the harder it is for me to go through all that to put them up. So I've been putting them out earlier. So,
yeah, understood.
We're fully decorated. Yeah.
Batman telling Gordon, he's like, yeah, I've got more urgent business tonight. And then just cut to Bruce Wayne seeing, like, Queens of the Stone Age are opening for Foo Fighters. He's like, I don't have tickets or something.
The guy's got to have a life. I would appreciate it if sometimes that were the urgent business.
And then Batman, yeah, I guess King tells him where the stash is. And this is when Batman goes to the pretty disheveled home of a father and two kids. And he says he knew Batman was going to come, and he'd been waiting there for 2 days, and thank God it's over. And he says he already gave everything back. And Batman's like, you gave them back? But I was like, why didn't Alfred say, hey, Master Bruce, this was on the doorstep. I mean, you know, it's kind of strange that how did he take him back? How was he not arrested when he brought him back?
I think he meant he took them to the police. I don't think he meant he brought them to each one of the houses that was robbed.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Or maybe Alfred just thinks it's an Amazon package and he'll get to it. I mean, this is a little early for Amazon. You know what I mean.
Bruce had it early because he's rich, you know, but yeah. I mean, you could be right. I mean, he said he tipped off the cops and he's the one who told Gordon where they could find the chessmen. And of course, he says he's not a thief. He just needed the money for his kids. And it's, you know, he says little boys shouldn't be left on their own. He's like, please don't throw me in jail. And there's this nice, you know, panel of the kid looking over the dad's shoulder at Batman. This poor guy, I mean, he seems, you know, you get the fact that this guy is, you know, of course he is being legit for this story. It's a Christmas story. So, of course, he's not yanking Batman's chain here. But I believe him. And obviously Batman does, too.
Yeah, I don't think he's living like that because just for show.
No.
So, yeah. So Batman leaves the role of Hundreds, which is awesome. But this is what I meant when I said I would have liked to have seen a little more Bruce Wayne, because in the 70s, you would have gotten a couple panels about Bruce Wayne offering this guy a job or some job training or something.
Yeah, or like in that the Old Wounds episode of the new Batman Adventures where the guy that Batman roughs up in front of his kids looking for the Joker, and that's what sets Dick off to quit being Robin. Yeah. Later on, he finds out Bruce Wayne gave him a job, and he's worked security ever since then for Bruce, and that, you know, Bruce is such an a-hole, you know, so...
I like the details in this guy's little apartment. Like, there's a space heater on the floor, clearly, like, drying the clothes by a line just in the middle of the room. Like, you can't afford a dryer or anything like that. There's a lamp that doesn't have a lampshade. This guy could really use the money he could have gotten from selling the stolen goods or fencing those. But his morality and his sense of right and wrong and wanting to do the right thing in front of his kids, even if it meant they were going to be hungry that night, was more compelling. And I think that's a cool, very Christmassy thing to show the goodwill of men. That's a nice little touch there.
Yeah. I hope he spent those hundreds on food and heat.
Yes.
Maybe a better place to live.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
Scratch tickets and the horse races.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, it's interesting in Bruce's old room, bedroom, and I'm not trying to be judgy about the toys Bruce has, but we've got like a doll, like a doll of a girl and a clown and a horse and a dollhouse. I mean, maybe some of this stuff's from when he was real young, or it could be his mom's toys that she passed down, but it just doesn't like read boy's room as much as I would have thought. I mean, the train does, but... You know, especially back, I know, you know, you're not supposed to force that stuff on kids nowadays like we, you know, as we grew up. But, you know, that Bruce is, you know, in his 30s or late 20s in the 90s. So, you know, that was a different time when he grew up. It just kind of surprised me what Yol chose to draw versus, you know, there's not, if he wants to draw old toys, wooden soldiers or anything like that, it's... The toys seem kind of lean, feminine, except for the train. I just thought that was interesting as a toy guy.
We could be prejudiced and blame it on the creative team being Brits.
Yeah. Where's his G.I. Joe, right? You know, where's his where's his Captain Action figure?
This is what posh British children's toys looks like. I don't know.
Ah, gotcha.
To me, it seems less feminine and more just kind of very old-fashioned. You mentioned like maybe even Martha's room, or Martha's toys or something like that. Like this seems like something like the image of like the wealthy prep kid from like the 50s or 60s or something, what they would have. Like it's almost like the toys have to have a sense of antiquity already just as toys, because like, of course he wouldn't be playing with toys even as a boy. He's the type of boy who was wearing a suit when he was like 6 years old or something like that. And it's, I don't know. There's just something kind of like less feminine, but more just kind of posh and sort of old world in there, that kind of toynessness. So,
Okay.
I agree. Like, I would have rather seen Buzz Lightyear in his collection, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, the Waynes didn't get to be rich by spending a lot of money on new toys. Those things were still in good shape.
Right. Yeah.
No USS flag for Brucey.
Yeah. Where would you put it, Master Bruce? You know.
Star Destroyer. I made it to the, I'm through childhood without a Star Destroyer.
There's a lot of space behind the grandfather clock in Dad's study.
Yeah.
There you go. It is really touching, though, to see, you know, Bruce, he's there in the, sitting in the floor with his, he's got just his pants, boots, and one panel his utility belt on, the next one he doesn't. But he's, you know, basically taking the top part of his costume off. And we see that he's got, it's a wind-up train, too, which I think is interesting. So it is an antique. It's not an electric, like an electric train set. So it's probably like something that was, you know, it was given to him, yes, you know, from his parents. It might have been new, but it was in the tradition of an old toy when he got it, which I like. The fact that Alfred, this is, it's getting late, Master Bruce, almost on. Time for bed, I think. In the way Batman's Bruce is sitting with his, on his, you know, knees, looking over his shoulder. I mean, that looks just like a little kid turns around and looks at their parent. Mm-hmm. It's real, I mean, it is really touching. And it says a lot about, you know, how we've brought up before, you know, the kind of arrested development of Bruce Wayne in some ways. He's still that little boy that, you know, he just grew up overnight. So there's that disconnect.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing. I had arrested development on the tip of my tongue before you said it. And that's a hard thing to admit when I look around at all of the toys in my room right now. however many thousands of dollars I've spent on these things.
Same here.
It's possible we just had better children than our parents and grandparents, or better childhoods, rather, than our parents and grandparents did, and consequently weren't so quick to leave it.
I think that's a lot of mine, honestly, yeah.
But you can tell Bruce is a grown-up, because when Alfred says time for bed, he doesn't fight it. He's like, oh, yeah, time for bed, absolutely, great idea.
But I don't want to go to bed.
I also like the train. yeah, exactly. I also like that the train is in Robin colors.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's where it came from.
Yep.
So, all right, any final thoughts on this one?
As happens a lot, I enjoyed reading this comic. Glad that this is the one that you wanted us to cover. And as I told Ryan in the process of the, spent a whole hour at a local comic shop, so I'm keeping the economy alive. But I enjoy it more because of this question. So I just really appreciate you having me on. And it's a nice thing for the Christmas season.
Well, thanks for coming on. It's been great to have you on here. And, you know, I don't know why this hasn't stuck with me more, because it, you know, obviously, you know, I am a little obsessed with toys, as is Ryan. And it's weird that this just isn't, I don't have this one just, you know, memorized front to back, but again, I forgot what this one was about until, you know, I really flipped it open. I remembered the cover again, like that arresting cover image, whether it's really relevant or not. I mean, I guess if they shown a toy train on the front, people been like, why is there a toy train on the cover of this Batman comic? That's some weird thing that would be on Sandman Mystery Theater. It would be a photograph of a toy train, right? And some strange angle with weird colors. And yeah, so but no, I'm glad we covered it. It feels a little bit, the ending does feel like, the fact that Batman lets the guy go and gives him money feels like a very Denny O'Neill type of ending. And he wrote quite a few of those Batman Christmas stories, and they were all very entertaining and always very touching and heartstring pulling. So it feels like this feels of a piece of with those.
Ryan, what about you?
Yeah, I didn't really care for it. Kat, we're going to do our listener feedback after this one. And we asked the question on the previous episode about favorite Batman artists of Mount Rushmore. Any particular favorites? You don't have to limit it to four, but certainly don't go more than five. Who would some of your favorite artists be?
Well, okay, I'm gonna cheat by inventing categories. So,
okay.
my favorite '70s artist, very similar to y'all's, you know, Jim Aparo, Marshall Rogers, Neil Adams, I mean, you know, and Don Newton. And just some of the best stories I read were Don Newton stories, and everything seemed real and gritty and really 70s New York. I really appreciate that. 80s artists, it's going to sound odd. I mean, obviously, you know, as we get into the 90s, you know, like Breyfogle and some of the classics you guys have talked about before, but John Byrne did a great Batman in the 80s. And and then 70s and 80s, I think about the Justice League artists, which is different categories, you know, the Dick Dillon Batman, George Perez Batman, Kevin Maguire Batman, which, you know, which I look Batman, but I always really enjoyed him because he could be funny and still be kind of scary. And Howard Porter Batman from the Grant Morrison JLA era. So, and I don't know as many of the new guys as you have. I see, honestly, the new comics are this, and some of the artistic quality is amazing, especially with the coloring, but the, and sometimes it's almost over rendered, but yeah, those are the ones that are top of mind for me.
Nice. Good list.
Yeah.
Oh, and JLGL, of course.
Yeah. Of course.
BBHM.
Right. Yeah, those are some good ones. I really liked Howard Porter in particular when you said that. I'm like, oh yeah, he really did draw a great Batman in JLA. That was one I hadn't thought of to come to mind. But yeah, he did a good job on that. Yeah. Well, Captain, thank you so much for stopping by and helping us cover this Christmas comic. And I know that you frequent our podcasts and other networks' podcasts. Do you have any coming up that you can tell us about, or is it all top secret?
No, it's all top secret. In fact, speaking of secret, I just had Diablo Frank just dropped a secret files with me in it. And of course, he always, you know, like all of you master editors and producers, he always makes me sound better than I did in the actual show and the recordings. So I appreciate that. I will point people to that, but I'm always looking for the next podcast appearance because it forces me to sit down and read a comic, and I appreciate that.
Well,
that's a lot of pressure on me to make this episode sound good.
Yeah.
I said better, not necessarily good.
As you know, the door is always open for more guest appearances. You're always welcome.
Well, I really appreciate it, but I will let you guys finish up and start warming up my sleigh.
We're going to bid adieu to Captain Entropy and have a happy holiday season to you. Safe travels. We know you're going to be, hopefully you're home and everything is safe by the time this episode comes out. But for the immediate future, folks, we're going to take a quick promo break. After that, Chris and I are going to unwrap some of our listener feedback that we received on the last couple of episodes. Stick around.
Science fiction, romance, swashbuckling adventure, all that and more is coming to DC Specialcast in 2026. I'm your host, Paul Ken. DC Specialcast is a podcast where each month a guest and I explore DC's special comics of the 1970s, like DC Special Series, DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, and others. This year, we'll have plenty of superhero action, including a special movie tie-in. But we also plan to cover Sergio Aragonés, The Star Hunters, Three Musketeers, and Love 1971.
But wait, there's more! Extra! Extra! Read all about it! I'm Sean M. Myers, and because Paul will not let me do a podcast about Newsies, we're going to do a special segment we are calling The Monthly Planet. I will join my Bat Brother Paul as we cover the 50th anniversary of the greatest series of DC House ads ever, The Daily Planet. Get ready to hear us talk about Direct Currents, Fred Hembeck, The Answer Man, and so much more.
So join us each month on DC Specialcast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Now that's special.
Okay, we're back from the break, and we're going to cover listener feedback on the last several episodes, starting with episode 43 and going forward to the previous episode. Episode 43 was There Is No Hope in Crime Alley and The Batman Nobody Knows. A lot of listeners mentioned where they first read these stories and shared their thoughts on the Fantastic Four movie.
First comment was from Super Captain. He said, Batwing was one of the unexpected pleasures for me in the New 52, but the story gets a little complicated. The first Batwing in the New 52 was David Zavimbi, who was based in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and his stories took place in Africa. After several issues, David resigned as Batwing, and Luke Fox, son of Lucius Fox, took over the identity. Lucius has another son, Tim Fox, also known as Jace. Luke was the smart, successful son, and Tim/Jace was a bit of a young delinquent. During the Future State event, DC published a two-parter set in the future, which showed Tim/Jace as the next Batman. Not long after that, DC published I Am Batman, in which Tim/Jace took on the identity of another Batman. Phew. Both of these were written by John Ridley, who wrote for Fresh Prince of Bel-Air on TV and the screenplay for 12 Years a Slave. I read John Ridley's his Black Lightning comic and one other, I can't remember. That was good. And then Captain said the Signal is Duke Thomas, who is younger and has served in the Robin role alongside Batman.
Well, thanks for straightening all that out, because I actually had no idea. So,
yeah,
good to know. I don't know how active are these characters. Well, somebody will let us know how active are these characters now. I could look that up, but I honestly, you know, I mean, are they? I don't even know how many Batman related titles there are now. I know there's 1,000. So
yeah, I don't either. Like I don't even follow like the other Robin books or anything either. Yeah.
No, I don't either. So, Bucky749 wrote in to say, here's a secret question for you two: if one character, hero, or villain from Batman the Animated Series got a solo miniseries, who would you choose? You'd think I'd have one off the top of my head with that. I think it'd be fun.
Assuming in the style of the animated series or a character that originated in the animated series. I wasn't sure about that.
Good. Yeah. If it's just in the style, I think, Ventriloquist Scarface miniseries would be fun. I think that would be fun.
That would be. Yeah, I'd like that. For an original Batman the Animated Series character, I always wanted to see more of the Red Claw, that woman and her terrorist organization from the first episode. I always thought that was really, there was a lot of potential there. Even like as not specific to Batman's world, she could have just been like a utility villain for any DC character, really.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, in that vein, I'd like to see a miniseries about Roxy Rocket, because she's just
sure is.
And I think I'm kind of surprised she hasn't like taken off more, because you know, no pun intended. Because you know, her whole thing is she literally is having an orgasm every time she's riding that rocket around, basically. So,
Tom King, get back on the Batman books. We need you.
Right, there you go.
Edo Boznar said, here is another vote for an episode that looks into more of the Barr Batman stories, particularly Annual Number 8 and the 1984 special. Those are on the list, Edo. We would like to get those. I even found out that Diablo Frank apparently is a fan of Batman Annual Issue 8 and that story, The Cult of the Crimson Sun, which... I don't know if we were ever going to get Diablo Frank on this podcast. I don't know what it would be like to talk about him, to talk about Batman for an hour with him, but that might be interesting.
Yeah. Those are definitely on the list. Those are two favorites of mine. So we'll get to them eventually for sure. Yeah. Paul Keehan from this very network, the host of DC Special Cast, says, as to There Is No Hope in Crime Alley, just a seminal story. So much, most good, some overdone, has come from it. This was the first comic I ever got signed by Denny O'Neil, old school, on the splash page. I was at a show in Philadelphia and saw he was there. I did not have anything with me, but found a duplicate of this issue and bought it, sitting on my vintage spinner rack right now. And another link, I have an original cell from Appointment in Crime Alley that I got at the WB store. It has Batman and Leslie with Batman kneeling down, putting the rose on the ground. Couldn't believe it when I found it, and still love it to this day. I look at it every time I go down to my comic book room. I just want to like put the Napoleon Dynamite meme of him going lucky, you know, because I'm like insanely jealous of that, Paul. So,
Gothos Mansion said, since you mentioned Batman Special Number 1, Michael Golden told me at a con that he didn't finish the book. I always thought the last few pages didn't look like his work. I got him to sign my Batman Special Number 1 at a con in Birmingham, Alabama. That is the only time I've ever let anyone write on my comics. I bought another copy so I would have one that hasn't been written on. I enjoy signed prints from artists, and I have a signed Denny O'Neill trading card, but there is still something that freaks me out if someone writes on my comics.
That's interesting. That is interesting. I've never really heard anybody... That's just such a common thing at conventions that... I get it. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're trying to keep it pristine and mint, then yeah, if they're writing on it, then yeah, from a certain point of view, yeah. And I actually heard, I think I heard that years ago that Mike DiCarlo basically finished that Batman special number one, but I didn't know for sure that it sounds like Michael Golden didn't even do the breakdowns on it, which I thought, assumed he did, but maybe he didn't at all.
Yeah, I hadn't heard anything about it. That's interesting.
Yeah. Nate the Great wrote in to say, good show on two stories that would not be done today. Nobody knows could be done with the Fantastic Four, not Batman. Modern Batman just would not go camping with kids. Crime Alley would be done in 5 pages, and the crook would turn out to be the Riddler's henchman. But yeah, the little quiet stories, they're hard to come by nowadays. That's true.
Brett Young from the Fantastic Poor podcast right here on the Fire and Water Network said, at this point, they need to just turn Crime Alley into a coffee shop or something so Batman will stop moping every year. Get a chilled iced coffee or some tea with boba pearls in it. I'm just spitballing here.
Oh, man.
Nice wordplay. Nice wordplay there, Brett. Well done.
Brett
Take
always,
a bow.
Yeah, he always comes in hot, don't he? Yeah. That's a good one, though. Martin Gray writes in, it only struck me while listening that this story, Crime Alley, perhaps had more of an effect on me than I realized. About 20 years ago, we were covering an assault on some poor soul by a block of flats near where I was living. The reporter didn't have a quote from a local, but hey, I was a local. So I said that this well-known trouble spot was known locally as Stab Alley, and so it became known. I'm not proud of myself. Wow, Martin created his own Crime Alley. Wow.
Love it.
Yeah.
On episode 44, we covered Detective Comics 477 and Batman and Robin Year One. Hey, Chris Franklin, I know that guy. He said, my apologies up front for misspeaking. The house that haunted Batman originally ran in Detective Comics 408, not Batman 408. Slip of the tongue, chums.
Yeah, that Batman 408 was like Batman Year One, you know, so it could have been that, right? So
that was so embarrassing for you.
I know. I haven't even left the house since then. Somebody who has left the house and it keeps introducing movies at nice revival theaters is film historian Rob Kelly. And he says, my favorite exchange of the episode, Chris, what's the Who's Who show Rob and Shag do now? Ryan, it differently. I don't know. I don't listen to it.
Rob McCarthy said, Clayface should be a major bat foe. Is Joker scary? Sure, but he can't turn into Superman and toss you into the sun. I agree with the premise. Clayface should be a bigger Batman villain. I don't know that he would get the strength of Superman, even if he could like change his shape into that, though.
Yeah, I don't think that comes with it. I don't think, unless it's a different version of Clayface I'm not aware of. Yeah,
I find fault with the second part of the premise, but the first part is sound. Yeah, I do think he should be more powerful. Well, he is, whether we want him to or not. Clayface is going to be a major bat foe soon. So
that's true. Yeah. Gothos Mansion writes in to say, I'm not sure why the reprint was used. I checked on Mike's Amazing World, RIP Mike, your site is a godsend. It definitely is. Action Comics number 45, which went on sale after Detective 477, featured a reprint of Superman 233 with a new framing sequence. So there could have been a scheduling glitch at DC. Len Wein's last issue of Spider-Man had a May 1978 cover date and his last issue of The Hulk an April 1978 cover date. So maybe that played into it as well. Chris's slip of the tongue about Batman 408 brought back up a guilty feeling for me. When I bought my Detective 408 back in the untamed early days of eBay, I bought it from a poor lady who was selling off her deceased husband's collection. She listed it as Batman and Batgirl number 408. She made no mention of Neil Adams because I'm sure she didn't know who he was. I got it for $4, shipping included. When it arrived, it was immaculate. I hate that she didn't realize what she had. It was too nice. I preferred to get readers that I didn't have to worry will get messed up. Not the best deal I ever got back in those early days, but it's up there. Wow. Yeah. There's a whole thing about, like, I've got into that with, like, people, like, if you buy something from somebody and, like, you get a great deal, but the person doesn't know what they got, is like, you know, some people are like, oh, yeah, you got a good deal. And other people are like, you should have paid them more. You should have, you know, I'm not saying you should have done that, Gothos. It's a discussion that when these people find these grails of toys and things like that, do you say anything? Do you offer them more than what they asked, or do you just take it and run? You know, I mean, there's different opinions about that. And I've never really figured out how I feel, because I've never quite had that situation happen to me.
I can't judge either party. It's got to be up to, you know, what would she ever find out later on what she could have gotten for it? Who knows? It's too much hypothetical in there to really kind of come down on any sort of moral judgment about it. So,
right, mm-hmm. Right.
Dr. Ange said, I don't like Dr. Zinzin, and then saw the Sienkiewicz Who's Who page. I like Dr. Zinzin because of the Sienkiewicz page. When I saw that page, I thought Zinzin was going to be a effing big deal. That picture is boss. Then I read most of Zinzin's appearances, and he is definitely not a big deal. Like I said, I really considered doing a Dr. Zinzin Christmas special for this episode, and I was like, nope, we already talked about him once this calendar year. That is way too much.
Yeah, and it's like a crazy, with the demon bear or something. It's crazy. It's I think John Callinan and David V. Reed. So if David V. Reed wrote it in the 70s, you know it's nuts, right? So, yeah. Bucky right. Said Before Nine writes again, here's my secret question. Who from Batman or Superman's rogue gallery should get his or her own TV show or movie or miniseries? I'll just say Clayface. Roxy Rocket. I'm going to stick with Roxy Rocket. Why not? You know, she could. James Gunn would love Roxy Rocket, I would think. That's a character perfect for James Gunn's sensibilities, you know. So there you go. Roxy Rocket.
Yeah, very much, yeah. I would like to see a Joker movie someday. I think that would be fun.
But no musicals.
Right. Episode 45, we did Detective Comics 478 and Batman and Robin Year 1, number 2. Dr. Ange said, Silver St. Cloud would make any man yell at the picture of his dead parents. Oh, that's going to be a contender for comment of the year, Ange.
That's a good one. Yeah. Especially the way Marshall Rogers drew her, because he's really the only person that drew her, right? But, well, I guess Walt Simonson drew her the first time, but yeah.
And then Rob McCarthy follows that up with another brilliant observation.
Yeah, of course, it didn't help that Bruce has portraits of his parents every 5 feet. It helps the mood. He's got to stay angry to be Batman. You know, if he's not motivated, like, constantly, he'll just go sit on the couch and, you know, in the 70s, watch Sanford and Son or something, you know? So it's like, he's got to have something to motivate him, you know?
Now I want to see, there's an image in my mind now of Bruce Wayne in the bathroom, just sitting on the toilet seat, and right next to him is a giant, like, 20 by 30 portrait of the Waynes.
They're judging him how he hangs.
Get out from under the shadow.
Martha's judging him how he hangs the toilet paper, overhand or underhand, you know?
Bucky 749. Sorry, Bucky 749. I'm going to guess right now that he's coming in with a question. He said, "My question is: before the event that changed his life, what comics did young Bruce read, and what comics do you think Dick reads?" Note for this thought experiment: Marvel Comics exist, and DC Golden Age, as we know, Barry Allen had them. Malibu, UK, and Now Comics exist, but no Image or Dark Horse.
That's a weird universe.
I'm not sure you can really. You're kind of gatekeeping our potential answers for your question, but okay, well, we'll play along. I would imagine, like, if Bruce would have been reading The Shadow, stuff like that, some of the pulps, you know, things of that nature, I can imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If there was a comic of the Grey Ghost, he read that. If Dick is reading Now Comics, he read Ralph Snart Adventures, because that's one of the few Now Comics that I remember. And my ex-brother-in-law loved that comic, and he bought all the issues, and I read them. And so that's, he read Ralph Snart. So.
Dick finds a stash of comics. He's like, who's this Howard Chaykin guy? And Bruce is like, put those away.
That's for our pal David A. Gutierrez. Super Captain writes in and says, Professor Payne slash Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, would have worked perfectly as a name if he had been introduced in the Silver Age. I could see him being called Professor Protoplasm or something like that. Later on in the 90s, he may have been called Waxwork or just Wax with two X's. Too bad the Melter was already taken. Later, Marv Wolfman would introduce Plasmus of the Brotherhood of Evil, who was essentially a German version of Clayface 3, minus the tragic backstory. Good point.
Edo Bosnar followed that up saying, yes, there was indeed a villain named Waxman. He was a Marvel character and first and last, as far as I know, appeared in Spider-Woman number 18, which came out about a year after this issue of Detective and was written by Ween's good buddy Marv Wolfman. In fact, Waxman may well have been inspired by this iteration of Clayface, because as I recall, vaguely, it's been ages since I've read it, he also had trouble retaining a normal human shape and often began melting into a gooey mess. I read that issue of Spider-Woman and have no memory of that, so need to revisit that at some point.
It's probably because Carmine Infantino was drawing her the way Carmine Infantino drew Spider-Woman. That's why you don't remember what the villain was about. Just a guess. Tim Price writes in of the Outcasters, and he says, so Preston's body is in danger of dissolving away, and he builds a containment suit with a cape. Because even with the horror his life has become, he still has style. He's got flair, man. You know, you can't hide that. You know, I mean, come on.
We got a comment from Mark Baker Wright who said, I really don't get why naming the Preston Payne character Clayface should cause such consternation. No, he's not the same as the previous version, nor was that version at all like the version before that. Companies like to maintain their trademarks. End of story. Deal with it. So, guys, this episode is coming out right around Christmas, and in the spirit of the holidays, I am going to give Mark the benefit of the doubt that he didn't mean to sound like a dick when he wrote this comment. Because that's really how I could have read it. But I'm gonna just choose to say, yeah, he meant that very innocently. And Merry Christmas, everybody.
Episode 46, Detective Comics number 479, and Batman and Robin Year One number 3. Edo Bosnar writes in and says, I really got a laugh when Chris suggested that maybe Batman should have seen Silver's face in the mannequin so that he and Clayface start fighting over it. The more I think about it, the more I wish that's what Ween had done with it. And I'm still open to someone doing it. And yeah, Roger's art in that issue of Detective is lovely, but I'm preaching to the choir. It's definitely too bad he didn't have a years-long run with the character at the time. And speaking of Rogers, he's definitely in my list of top Batman artists, along with Neil Adams, no explanation needed, I think. Alan Davis, loved his all-too-brief run on Detective with Mike Barr. And especially Jim Aparo. To me, Aparo is almost a quintessential Bat artist. Whenever Batman is mentioned, I think the Aparo version is the first image that pops into my head. The others who come close to that personal Mount Rushmore are Don Newton and JLGLPBHN.
I forgot to mention this last episode or any of the last previous episodes, even though it was in my notes. I kept forgetting about it. Marshall Rogers actually drew one of the very first comics I ever read, and it was an issue of G.I. Joe, of all things.
Mm-hmm.
I've said before that the first comics I ever read were G.I. Joe issues 73, 74, and 75. I got them all at once, and Marshall Rogers drew one of those. It was like a film because for that brief time period, G.I. Joe was, if you can believe it, was published twice a month. And
yeah,
and he drew one of the interstitial chapters to give the break to the regular penciler. Kind of weird to even think about it, but yeah, Marshall Rogers was like the second comic book artist I was really exposed to, really.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I have an issue drawn by him, so it's probably that one issue. So yeah, G.I. Joe, yeah.
Tim Price said, I try to give the superhero leniency on stopping a bad guy sciencing, and Clayface being a repeat killer that turns people into sludge and is in love with a mannequin, he is not exactly building confidence in his intentions. But if I had a nickel for every time a hero stopped a villain from curing or depowering themselves, I'd have a back-breaking bag of nickels. So I really don't like it. And Batman was no exception here, especially with how callously his dialogue was written. Still, it was a gripping story, and rarely is Batman shown having problems that aren't caused by a supervillain, so I appreciated him actually grappling with losing Silver. I don't have an interesting answer for Batman artists outside of who you both mentioned, but what I just thought about is who you would say are your favorite Robin artists. Is there overlap with the Batman list or completely different?
Yeah, for me, I'd say the first thing that pops in my head is George Perez for the, you know, Robin, pre-Nightwing Robin in New Teen Titans. And I like Don Newton, his take. All the guys that drew the Teen Wonder Robin at that time, he was like literally like the costume didn't fit him anymore. He was like about ready to, well, Marshall Rogers did show him like the laces busted on his shirt. I mean, that just proved, get that guy out of that costume, mm-hmm. you know. But I liked all those guys. I liked how Carmen mm-hmm. Infantino drew Robin in the New Look era. I like Dick Sprang's Robin. These are all guys that drew Dick as Robin. Tom Grummett, Mike Waringo, when they were both drew Tim Drake's series.
Oh, yeah.
They come to mind as favorites.
The first one that came to my mind was the same as you. I thought of George Perez because no other artist could draw a grown-up Robin in that costume and make it work mm-hmm. better than George Perez.
Nope.
Like, that was just an uncanny feat to make that costume not look silly on a young man of that age, as he was supposed to be in those comics.
Yeah.
I would co-sign all the other artists that you mentioned. And also, I mean, maybe just because an earlier comment reminded me of it, but Alan Davis, the way he drew Robin in that little in the short run that we covered, that was really good.
Yeah, the little pixie Robin. He looked like a little elf.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I like the contrast that. Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah. Rob McCarthy writes in again and says, okay, bear with me. I think I fixed the plot hole. This was the plot hole that Batman somehow didn't know how he ended up at Clayface's lair of the Wax Museum with no clues that we knew of. Right. Batman mostly fights normal guys, but the bigger Batman villains like Hugo Strange, the Joker, Catwoman seem like normal people, but they live through fatal injuries all the time. They might not be human. Superman, Wonder Woman, Martian Manhunter. He says Hackman. I'm assuming he means Hawkman, not Gene Hackman. And 3,599 Green Lanterns are alien. So what if Batman built a bat non-standard DNA detector? Naturally, Clayface's DNA is non-standard, so it stands out. That's how Batman tracked him. Well, you know, why not, Rob? Because, you know, it sounds like something Adam West would have in his utility belt, so let's just go with it.
And I mentioned that in the comments. I was like, that actually is a pretty good solve for him. I mean, like, why not, as you said. Yeah,
in universe, DC Universe, it makes sense.
Bucky749 said, here's my secret question. In one of the Batman the Animated Series episodes, Bruce and Dick watch It's a Wonderful Life at the end of the episode. Well, that was the Christmas episode, Christmas with the Joker.
Yep.
Bucky said, have you watched this now Christmas classic? And do you have a movie that you watch every year at Christmas time or around Christmas? Please do not say Elf or A Christmas Story, as I feel those are overdone. Wizard of Oz or White Christmas or even Santa Claus with Muscles or even a Charlie Brown or Garfield Christmas special are fine. Or Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Bucky, again, you can't put these parameters on questions like this for us. Like, it's like, what if the honest answer was Elf and you just said you feel those are overdone? But hey, what if that's the honest answer? Anyway, to actually answer, yes, of course, I have seen It's a Wonderful Life. As for the regular, the kind of traditional Christmas movies that we watch every year, Scrooged, the Bill Murray one, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, and then lots of different versions of A Christmas Carol, from Mickey's Christmas Carol to the Muppets version to the Alistair Sim one. It's my favorite Christmas story, so I watch all those. But yeah, growing up for like a period of like 30 years, if not more, we always watched Scrooged and National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation right before Christmas. So.
Yeah, I pretty much co-sign all those you said. And yes, I've seen It's a Wonderful Life. But we watch White Christmas. I already watched A Christmas Story while we were decorating the tree the other day, and A Christmas Story, the sequel that came out a few years ago, which is actually really good. You know, got to watch Christmas Vacation, got to watch the Alistair Sim Scrooge, got to watch the musical Albert Finney Scrooge, got to watch the Muppet Christmas Carol. There's certain ones. I watched, we were decorating the other Christmas, the rest of Christmas inside the house, and I just had all the Rankin Bass specials on. I still got the DVDs from when the kids were little. I popped them in. They were on in the background, so mm-hmm. we watched those. And, you know, watched Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, where Santa Claus is a real asshole. And that, my God, that guy's just awful in that. It's like, and then I watched Santa Claus is Coming to Town. That's my favorite. With the Mickey Rooney as Santa Claus. That's my favorite Rankin Bass. But yeah, Santa's such a jerk in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It's awful.
She makes a big deal about the skinny Santa. Maybe he was just hangry. Maybe that's why he was a jerk in the beginning of the episode.
Maybe that could very well be it. Yeah, he's trying to, and nobody wants him to diet but himself. Maybe he's just self-loathing or something. I don't know. But Brett Young from this very network says Mount Rushmore. Neil Adams reading the Batman from the 30s to the 70s as a kid and turning the page to see Adams' work was mind blowing. Batman looked so intense and real. And he was always in a tree for some reason. Yeah, that's true. Don Newton, he gave Batman realism plus an organic look and feel. It was like watching a TV show. Every character looked real and different, perfect and unique for the time. Yeah, Don Newton was great. Like, all the thugs had different faces. Everybody had a different build. That's true. Tim Sale, it may or may not be popular choice with others, but I loved his cartoony, ugly, in quote, style in The Long Halloween and Dark Victory. His Batman stood out from the other characters as a broad-shouldered superhero. Plus, I'm a sucker for Commissioner Gordon's glasses not showing his eyes. Greg Capullo. He has a long enough Batman resume to belong on this list. He gave Batman a youthful but powerful and determined look. At the time, it was a breath of fresh air for the Dark Knight. Yeah, I mean, those all, you know, I have mentioned before, I am not a huge Tim Sale fan. Rest in peace. I admire, he was a great artist. Just not my personal taste of art I really like, but I can appreciate that it's very well done within, you know, he's a good artist. He's a great artist. I'm just not into that particular, it's just like being, I'm not into that kind of music, but I can say you're a great musician. It's kind of like that type of thing, so.
I in particularly love the way Tim Sale drew Catwoman. I really like the way he draws the curves of Selina Kyle. It's very nice.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Super Captain said, for Mount Rushmore of Batman artists, today mine would be Neil Adams, the GOAT, in my humble opinion, Jim Aparo, Tim Sale, and Graham Nolan. But there are so many, like Rogers, Sprang, Breyfogle, Daniels, etc. Yeah, I can. Again, all of those we agree with.
Mm-hmm. Rob Kelly says, am I the only one who wants to hear Chris combine his Batman and Jerry Reed impersonations? And in the comments, I said something like, I am vengeance. I am the knight. I am the snowman, son. Sub question. If Jerry Reed appeared on Batman 66, what villain would you want him to have played? The Clue Master. I could just see, and then they could introduce Stephanie Brown and she could have a Southern accent. And she could, you know, the spoiler could have, you know, she could sound like, you know, Cindy, you know, basically. So. And he could sound like me. So there you go.
I'm going to say Maxi Zeus.
Oh, wow.
have Jerry Reed as that Southern Greek god try to mix those two worlds together.
I love it. That's awesome.
We got a comment from Flanger, a.k.a. Paul Hicks, who said, Batman no longer has a robot hand. He received a gifted graft of a Bruce Wayne clone's hand. This was wrapped up in the last few issues of Zdarsky's run, but Alfred is still dead. I read this comment, and I was like, why does that not sound familiar to me? And then it occurred to me, I don't think I read the last issue of Zdarsky's run.
No.
How did I skip that one? But okay.
Oh, well, you know, they can give Bruce Wayne a cloned hand, but they can't bring Alfred back from the dead. Okay. All right.
He's a hologram now. They still use him.
I know. Jim writes in, is this Jim Gordon? It's somebody named Jim. A Mount Rushmore of Batman artists is difficult to narrow down. Neil Adams, Jim Aparo are a must for me. I'm having a difficult time making up my mind filling the last two spots between Dick Sprang, Marshall Rogers, and Don Newton. I've read a lot more Batman stories drawn by Sprang and Newton, so I guess I'll go with those two. Always a safe bet.
And then some of our other Fire and Water Network friends gave us their lists too. Paul Kane said Jim Aparo, Don Newton, Norm Brayfogle, and Neil Adams. Sean Myers said Marshall Rogers, Mike Parabek, not even, George Perez, and Neil Adams. And then Sean qualified it. Perez doesn't count, then Jim Lee. And I would say George Perez does count because I don't want Jim Lee on his list. And then Sean Ross said Jim Aparo, Dan Mora, who we talked about. Sean Martin, bro, interesting pull. And then is it Michael Jenin or Yenin? I'm not sure how to pronounce that guy's name, Michael Jenin.
Yeah.
More of a recent artist addition. But yeah, interesting list from Sean Ross. Those are, yeah, Sean Martin, bro, much more of an indie style, almost any cartoonish style. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I like that Sean Myers put in Mike Parabek. That's obviously, you know, very influential. Of course, he took off from the Bruce Timm, but he did his own thing with it, you know, and he was already drawing that way anyway. So it just kind of worked out that way. So yeah, that's, you know, obviously a huge impact. A lot of younger readers, especially, you know, in the 90s, that was their Batman, I'm sure, in comics. So,
alrighty, folks, that wraps up this Christmas and listener feedback special. This was a lot of fun. Want to thank Captain Entropy for being our guest on this one again. We had a lot of fun. For the month of January, we will be back to resume our coverage of Batman and Robin Year One. And then the other comic, we're going to start the first of a two-parter. We're going to stay in the realm of Legends of the Dark Knight, but the first of a two-parter featuring one of my favorite Batman rogues. And you'll have to wait until 2026 to find out which one we're talking about.
A whole year.
I'll post it in advance of the episode so that you can actually read it before we do the episodes.
Yeah. Ah, there you go. Yeah, we got to wait. You got to wait a whole year to find out. No, not a whole year. Just. Well, we want to wish all our listeners a happy holidays, Merry Christmas, whatever you celebrate, Happy Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate. And Ryan, happy Merry Christmas to you, happy holidays, happy New Year to everyone. And thank you all so much for listening, all your great feedback. Keep it coming. Let us know what your favorite Batmobile is. And I hope you get something from one of your Mount Rushmore of Batman artists under your Christmas tree this year.
Someday soon we'll all be together.
Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find Batman Nightcast and the Fire and Water Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
As always, thank you for listening and Merry Christmas.
So yourself.